Dear Father, Dear Mother, Dear Ravi, greetings. Your loving son and brother is coming to meet you. Not an hour has gone by that I haven't thought of you. The moment I see you will be the happiest of my life. And now I leave matters in the hands of God, who is love and whom I love.
I heard the words. Is someone there? It's astonishing what you hear when you're alone in the blackness of your dying mind. A sound without shape or color sounds strange. To be blind is to hear otherwise. The words came again. Is someone there? I concluded that I had gone mad. Sad but true. Misery loves company, and madness calls it forth. Is someone there? Came the voice again, insistent. The clarity of my insanity was astonishing. The voice had its very own timbre, with a heavy, weary rasp. I decided to play along.
Of course someone's there, I replied. There's always someone there. Who would be asking the question otherwise?
I was hoping there would be someone else.
What do you mean, someone else? Do you realize where you are? If you're not happy with this figment of your fancy, pick another one. There are plenty of fancies to pick from.
Figment. Figment. Wouldn't a fig be good? So, there's no one, is there?
Shush. I'm dreaming of figs.
Figs! Do you have a fig? Please, can I have a piece? I beg you. Only a little piece. I'm starving.
I don't have just one fig. I have a whole figment.
A whole figment of figs. Oh, please, can I have some? The voice, or whatever effect of wind and waves it was, faded.
They're plump and heavy and fragrant, I continued. The branches of the tree are bent over. They are so weighed down with figs. There must be over 300 figs in that tree.
Silence. The voice came back again. Let's talk about food.
What a good idea.
What would you have to eat if you could have anything you wanted?
Excellent question. I would have a magnificent buffet. I would start with rice and sambar. There would be black gram dal rice and curd rice and... I'm not finished. And with my rice I would have spicy tamarind sambar and small onion sambar and...
Anything else?
I'm getting there. I'd also have mixed vegetable sagu and vegetable korma and potato masala and cabbage vadai and masala dosa and spicy lentil rasam and...
I see.
Wait. And stuffed eggplant poriyal and coconut yam kutta and rice idli and curd vadai and vegetable bhaji and...
It sounds very...
Have I mentioned the chutneys yet? Coconut chutney and mint chutney and green chili pickle and gooseberry pickle all served with the usual naans, papadams, parathas and puris, of course.
Sounds...
The salads. Mango curd salad and okra curd salad and plain fresh cucumber salad. And for dessert... Almond payasam and milk payasam and jaggery pancake and peanut toffee and coconut barfi and vanilla ice cream with hot, thick chocolate sauce.
Is that it?
I'd finish this snack with a 10-liter glass of fresh, clean, cool, chilled water and a coffee.
He sounds very good.
It does.
Tell me, what is coconut yam, Kuta?
Nothing short of heaven, that's what.
To make it, you need yams, grated coconut, green plantains, chili powder, ground black pepper, ground turmeric, cumin seeds, brown mustard seeds, and some coconut oil.
You saute the coconut until it's golden brown.
May I make a suggestion?
What?
Instead of coconut yam, Kuta, why not boiled beef tongue with a mustard sauce?
That sounds non-veg.
It is. And then tripe.
Tripe? You've eaten the poor animal's tongue and now you want to eat its stomach?
Yes. I dream of tripes a la Modaka. Warm with sweet bread.
Sweet bread? That sounds better. What is sweet bread?
Sweet bread is made from the pancreas of a calf.
The pancreas?
Braised and with a mushroom sauce. It's simply delicious. Where were these disgusting, sacrilegious recipes coming from? Was I so far gone that I was contemplating setting upon a cow and her young? What horrible crosswind was I caught in? Had the lifeboat drifted back into that floating trash?
What will be the next affront?
Calf's brains in a brown butter sauce.
Back to the head, are we?
Brain souffle.
I'm feeling sick. Is there anything you won't eat?
What I would give for oxtail soup. For roast suckling pig stuffed with rice, sausages, apricots and raisins. For veal kidney in a butter, mustard and parsley sauce. For marinated rabbit stewed in red wine. For chicken liver sausages. For pork and liver pate with veal. For frogs.
Give me frogs.
Give me frogs.
I'm barely holding on.
The voice faded. I was trembling with nausea. Madness in the mind was one thing, but it was not fair that it should go to the stomach. Understanding suddenly dawned on me.
Would you eat bleeding raw beef?
I asked. Of course. I love tartar steak.
Would you eat the congealed blood of a dead pig?
Every day, with applesauce.
Would you eat anything from an animal? The last remains?
Scrapple and sausage. I'd have a heaping plate.
How about a carrot? Would you eat a plain raw carrot?
There was no answer.
Did you not hear me? Would you eat a carrot?
I heard you. To be honest, if I had a choice, I wouldn't. I don't have much of a stomach for that kind of food. I find it quite distasteful. I laughed. I knew it. I wasn't hearing voices. I hadn't gone mad. It was Richard Parker who was speaking to me. The carnivorous rascal. All this time together and he had chosen an hour before we were to die to pipe up. I was elated to be on speaking terms with a tiger. Immediately, I was filled with a vulgar curiosity, the sort that movie stars suffer from at the hands of their fans.
I'm curious. Tell me. Have you ever killed a man?
I doubted it. Man-eaters among animals are as rare as murderers among men, and Richard Parker was caught while still a cub. But who's to say that his mother, before she was nabbed by Thirsty, hadn't caught a human being? What a question, replied Richard Parker.
Seems reasonable.
He does? Yes. Why?
You have the reputation that you have.
I do.
Of course. Are you blind to that fact?
I am.
Well, let me make clear what you evidently can't see. You have that reputation. So, have you ever killed a man?
Silence.
Well, answer me.
Yes.
Oh, it sends shivers down my spine. How many?
Two.
You've killed two men?
No. A man and a woman.
At the same time?
No. The man first, the woman second.
You monster! I bet you thought it was great fun. You must have found their cries and their struggles quite entertaining.
Not really.
Were they good?
Were they good?
Yes. Don't be so obtuse. Did they taste good?
No. They didn't taste good.
I thought so. I've heard it's an acquired taste in animals. So why did you kill them?
Need.
The need of a monster. Any regrets?
It was them or me.
That is need expressed in all its amoral simplicity. But any regrets now?
It was a doing of a moment. It was circumstance.
Instinct. It's called instinct. Still, answer the question. Any regrets now?
I don't think about it.
The very definition of an animal. That's all you are.
And what are you?
A human being, I'll have you know.
What boastful pride.
It's the plain truth.
So you would throw the first stone, would you?
Have you ever had uttappam?
No, I haven't. But tell me about it. What is uttappam?
It is so good.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Uttappam is often made with leftover batter, but rarely has a culinary afterthought been so memorable.
I can already taste it. I fell asleep, or rather, into a state of dying delirium. But something was niggling at me. I couldn't say what. Whatever it was disturbing my dying. I came to. I knew what it was that was bothering me.
Excuse me.
Yes, came Richard Barker's voice faintly.
Why do you have an accent?
I don't. It is you who has an accent.
No, I don't. You pronounce the, za.
I pronounce the, za, as it should be. You speak with warm marbles in your mouth. You have an Indian accent.
You speak as if your tongue were a saw and English words were made of wood. You have a French accent.
It was utterly incongruous. Richard Parker was born in Bangladesh and raised in Tamil Nadu, so why should he have a French accent? Granted, Pondicherry was once a French colony, but no one would have me believe that some of the zoo animals had frequented the Alliance Française on Rue Dumas. It was very perplexing. I fell into a fog again. I woke up with a gasp. Someone was there. This voice coming to my ears was neither a wind with an accent nor an animal speaking up. It was someone else. My heart beat fiercely, making one last go at pushing some blood through my worn-out system. My mind made a final attempt at being lucid.
Only an echo, I fear,
I heard barely audibly.
Wait, I'm here,
I shouted.
An echo at sea.
No, it's me,
that this would end.
My friend!
I'm wasting away.
Stay! Stay!
I could barely hear him. I shrieked. He shrieked back. It was too much. I would go mad. I had an idea.
My name,
I roared to the elements with my last breath,
is Bisin Molitor Patel.
How could an echo create a name?
Do you hear me? I am Bisin Molitor Patel, known to all as Pai Patel.
What? Is someone there?
Yes, someone's there.
What? Can it be true?
Please, do you have any food? Anything at all? I have no food left.
I haven't eaten anything in days.
I must have something.
I'll be grateful for whatever you can spare. I beg you.
But I have no food either,
I answered, dismayed.
I haven't eaten anything in days myself. I was hoping you would have food. Do you have water? My supplies are very low.
No, I don't. You have no food at all?
Nothing. No. Nothing.
There was silence. A heavy silence.
Where are you?
I asked.
I'm here,
he replied wearily.
But where is that? I can't see you.
Why can't you see me?
I've gone blind.
What?
He exclaimed.
I've gone blind. My eyes see nothing but darkness. I blink for nothing. These last 2 days, if my skin can be trusted to measure time, it only can tell me if it's day or night.
I heard a terrible wail.
What? What is it, my friend?
I asked. He kept wailing.
Please answer me. What is it? I'm blind and we have no food and water, but we have each other. That is something. Something precious. So what is it, my dear brother?
I too am blind.
What?
I too blink for nothing, as you say.
He wailed again. I was struck dumb. I had met another blind man on another lifeboat in the Pacific.
But how could you be blind?
I mumbled.
Probably for the same reason you are. The result of poor hygiene on a starving body at the end of its tether.
We both broke down. He wailed and I sobbed. It was too much. Truly it was too much.
I have a story,
I said after a while.
A story?
Yes.
Of what use is a story? I'm hungry.
It's a story about food.
Words have no calories.
Seek food where food is to be found.
That's an idea. Silence. A famishing silence.
Where are you?
He asked.
Here. And you?
Here.
I heard a splashing sound as an oar dipped into water. I reached for one of the oars I had salvaged from the wrecked raft. It was so heavy. I felt with my hands and found the closest oar lock. I dropped the oar in it. I pulled on the handle. I had no strength, but I rowed as best I could.
Let's hear your story,
he said, panting.
Once upon a time there was a banana and it grew. It grew until it was large, firm, yellow and fragrant. Then it fell to the ground and someone came upon it and ate it.
He stopped rowing.
What a beautiful story.
Thank you.
I have tears in my eyes.
I have another element,
I said.
What is it?
The banana fell to the ground and someone came upon it and ate it. And afterwards that person felt better.
It takes the breath away, he exclaimed.
Thank you.
A pause. But you don't have any bananas?
No. An orangutan distracted me.
A what?
It's a long story.
Any toothpaste?
No.
Delicious on fish. Any cigarettes?
I ate them already.
You ate them?
I still have the filters. You can have them if you like.
The filters? What would I do with cigarette filters without the tobacco? How could you eat cigarettes?
What should I have done with them? I don't smoke.
You should have kept them for trading.
Trading? With whom?
With me.
My brother, when I eat them, I was alone in a lifeboat in the middle of the Pacific.
So?
So the chance of meeting someone in the middle of the Pacific with whom to trade my cigarettes did not strike me as an obvious prospect.
You have to plan ahead, you stupid boy. Now you have nothing to trade.
But even if I had something to trade, what would I trade it for? What do you have that I would want?
I have a boat, he said.
A boot?
Yes, a fine leather boot.
What would I do with a leather boot in a lifeboat in the middle of the Pacific? Do you think I go for hikes in my spare time?
You could eat it.
Eat a boot? What an idea.
You eat cigarettes? Why not a boot?
The idea is disgusting. Whose boot, by the way?
How should I know?
You're suggesting I eat a complete stranger's boot?
What difference does it make?
I'm flabbergasted. A boot. Putting aside the fact that I'm a Hindu and we Hindus consider cows sacred, eating a leather boot conjures to my mind eating all the filth that a foot might exude in addition to all the filth it might step in while shod.
So no boot for you.
Let's see it first.
No.
What? Do you expect me to trade something with you sight unseen?
We're both blind, may I remind you.
Describe this boot to me then. What kind of a pitiful salesman are you? No wonder you're starved for customers.
That's right, I am.
Well, the boot?
It's a leather boot.
What kind of leather boot?
The regular kind.
Which means?
A boot with a shoelace and eyelets and a tongue. With an inner sole. The regular kind.
What color?
Black.
In what condition?
Worn. The leather soft and supple. Lovely to the touch.
And the smell?
Of warm, fragrant leather.
I must admit. It sounds tempting.
You can forget about it.
Why?
Silence.
Will you not answer, my brother?
There's no boot.
No boot?
No.
That makes me sad.
I ate it.
You ate the boot?
Yes.
Was it good?
No. Was the cigarettes good?
No. I couldn't finish them.
I couldn't finish the boot.
Once upon a time, there was a banana and it grew. It grew until it was large, firm, yellow and fragrant. Then it fell to the ground and someone came upon it and ate it and afterwards that person felt better.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all I've said, Inzan. I'm a worthless person. He burst out.
What do you mean? You are the most precious, wonderful person on earth. Come, my brother. Let us be together and feast on each other's company.
Yes. The Pacific is no place for rowers, especially when they are weak and blind, when the lifeboats are large and unwieldy, and when the wind is not cooperating. He was close by. He was far away. He was to my left. He was to my right. He was ahead of me. He was behind me. But at last we managed it. Our boats touched with a bump even sweeter sounding than a turtle's. He threw me a rope, and I tethered his boat to mine.
I open my arms to embrace him and to be embraced by him. My eyes were brimming with tears and I was smiling. He was directly in front of me, a presence glowing through my blindness.
My sweet brother,
I whispered.
I am here,
he replied. I heard a faint growl.
Brother, there's something I forgot to mention.
He landed upon me heavily. We fell half onto the tarpaulin, half onto the middle bench. His hands reached for my throat.
Brother, I gasped through his over-eager embrace. My heart is with you, but I must urgently suggest we repair to another part of my humble ship.
You're damn right your heart is with me,
he said.
And your liver, and your flesh.
I could feel him moving off the tarpaulin onto the middle bench and fatally bringing a foot down to the floor of the boat.
No, no, my brother, don't! We're not!
I tried to hold him back. Alas, it was too late. Before I could say the word alone, I was alone again. I heard the merest clicking of claws against the bottom of the boat, no more than the sound of a pair of spectacles falling to the floor, and the next moment my dear brother shrieked in my face like I've never heard a man shriek before. He let go of me. This was the terrible cost of Richard Parker. He gave me a life, my own, but at the expense of taking one. He ripped the flesh off the man's frame and cracked his bones. The smell of blood filled my nose. Something in me died then that has never come back to life. Chapter 91. I climbed aboard my brother's boat. With my hands I explored it. I found he had lied to me. He had a little turtle meat, a dorado head, and even, a supreme treat, some biscuit crumbs. And he had water. It all went into my mouth. I returned to my boat and released his. Crying as I had done did my eyes some good. The small window at the top left of my vision opened a crack. I rinsed my eyes with seawater. With every rinsing, the window opened further. My vision came back within 2 days. I saw such a vision that I nearly wished I had remained blind. His butchered, dismembered body lay on the floor of the boat. Richard Parker had amply supped on him, including on his face, so that I never saw who my brother was. His eviscerated torso, with its broken ribs curving up like the frame of a ship, looked like a miniature version of the lifeboat, such was its blood-drenched and horrifying state. I will confess that I caught one of his arms with the gaff and used his flesh as bait. I will further confess that, driven by the extremity of my need and the madness to which it pushed me, I ate some of his flesh. I mean small pieces, little strips that I meant for the gaff's hook that, when dried by the sun, looked like ordinary animal flesh. They slipped into my mouth nearly unnoticed. You must understand, my suffering was unremitting and he was already dead. I stopped as soon as I caught a fish. I pray for his soul every day. Chapter 92. I made an exceptional botanical discovery, but there will be many who disbelieve the following episode. Still, I give it to you now because it's part of the story and it happened to me. I was on my side. It was an hour or two past noon on a day of quiet sunshine and gentle breeze. I had slept a short while, a diluted sleep that had brought no rest and no dreams. I turned over to my other side, expending as little energy as possible in doing so. I opened my eyes. In the near distance, I saw trees. I did not react. I was certain it was an illusion that a few blinks would make disappear. The trees remained. In fact, they grew to be a forest. They were part of a low-lying island. I pushed myself up. I continued to disbelieve my eyes. But it was a thrill to be deluded in such a high-quality way. The trees were beautiful. They were like none I had ever seen before. They had a pale bark and equally distributed branches that carried an amazing profusion of leaves. These leaves were brilliantly green, a green so bright and emerald that, next to it, vegetation during the monsoons was drab olive. I blinked deliberately, expecting my eyelids to act like lumberjacks. But the trees would not fall. I looked down. I was both satisfied and disappointed with what I saw. The island had no soil. Not that the trees stood in water. Rather, they stood in what appeared to be a dense mass of vegetation, as sparkling green as the leaves. Who had ever heard of land with no soil, with trees growing out of pure vegetation? I felt satisfaction because such a geology confirmed that I was right, that this island was a chimera, a play of the mind. By the same token, I felt disappointment because an island, any island, however strange, would have been very good to come upon. Since the trees continued to stand, I continued to look. To take in green after so much blue was like music to my eyes. Green is a lovely color. It is the color of Islam. It is my favorite color. The current gently pushed the lifeboat closer to the illusion. Its shore could not be called a beach, there being neither sand nor pebbles, and there was no pounding of surf either, since the waves that fell upon the island simply vanished into its porosity. From a ridge some 300 yards inland, the island sloped to the sea and, 40 or so yards into it, fell off precipitously, disappearing from sight into the depths of the Pacific, surely the smallest continental shelf on record. I was getting used to the mental delusion. To make it last, I refrained from putting a strain on it. When the lifeboat nudged the island, I did not move, only continued to dream. The fabric of the island seemed to be an intricate, tightly webbed mass of tube-shaped seaweed, in diameter a little thicker than 2 fingers. What a fanciful island, I thought. After some minutes, I crept up to the side of the boat. Look for green, said the survival manual. Well, this was green. In fact, it was chlorophyll heaven. A green to outshine food coloring and flashing neon lights. A green to get drunk on. Ultimately, a foot is the only good judge of land, pursued the manual. The island was within reach of a foot. To judge and be disappointed, or not to judge, that was the question. I decided to judge. I looked about to see if there were sharks. There were none. I turned on my stomach, and holding on to the tarpaulin, I slowly brought a leg down. My foot entered the sea. It was pleasingly cool. The island lay just a little further down, shimmering in the water. I stretched. I expected the bubble of illusion to burst at any second. It did not. My foot sank into clear water and met the rubbery resistance of something flexible but solid. I put more weight down. The illusion would not give. I put my full weight on my foot. Still I did not sink. Still I did not believe. Finally, it was my nose that was the judge of land. It came to my olfactory sense, full and fresh, overwhelming. The smell of vegetation. I gasped. After months of nothing but salt water bleached smells, this reek of vegetable organic matter was intoxicating. It was then that I believed, and the only thing that sank was my mind. My thought process became disjointed. My leg began to shake.
"My God. My God,"
I whimpered. I fell overboard. The combined shock of solid land and cool water gave me the strength to pull myself forward onto the island. I babbled incoherent thanks to God and collapsed. But I could not stay still. I was too excited. I attempted to get to my feet. Blood rushed away from my head. The ground shook violently. A dizzying blindness overcame me. I thought I would faint. I steadied myself. All I seemed able to do was pant. I managed to sit up.
"Richard Parker! Land! Land! We are saved!"
I shouted. The smell of vegetation was extraordinarily strong. As for the greenness, it was so fresh and soothing that strength and comfort seemed to be physically pouring into my system through my eyes. What was this strange tubular seaweed so intricately entangled? Was it edible? It seemed to be a variety of marine algae, but quite rigid, far more so than normal algae. The feel of it in the hand was wet and as of something crunchy. I pulled at it. Strands of it broke off without too much effort. In cross-section, it consisted of two concentric walls. The wet, slightly rough outer wall, so vibrantly green, and an inner wall midway between the outer wall and the core of the algae. The division in the two tubes that resulted was very plain. The center tube was white in color, while the tube that surrounded it was decreasingly green as it approached the inner wall. I brought a piece of the algae to my nose. Beyond the agreeable fragrance of the vegetable, it had a neutral smell. I licked it. My pulse quickened. The algae was wet with fresh water. I bit into it. My chops were in for a shock. The inner tube was bitterly salty, but the outer was not only edible, it was delicious. My tongue began to tremble as if it were a finger flipping through a dictionary, trying to find a long-forgotten word. It found it, and my eyes closed with pleasure at hearing it. Sweet. Not as in good, but as in sugary. Turtles and fish are many things, but they are never, ever sugary. The algae had a light sweetness that outdid in delight even the sap of our maple trees here in Canada. In consistency, the closest I can compare to it is water chestnuts. Saliva forcefully oozed through the dry pastiness of my mouth. Making loud noises of pleasure, I tore at the algae around me. The inner and outer tubes separated cleanly and easily. I began stuffing the sweet outer into my mouth. I went at it with both hands, force-feeding my mouth and setting it to work harder and faster than it had in a very long time. I ate till there was a regular moat around me. A solitary tree stood about 200 feet away. It was the only tree downhill from the ridge, which seemed a very long way off. I say ridge. The word perhaps gives an incorrect impression of how steep the rise from the shore was. The island was low-lying, as I've said. The rise was gentle, to a height of perhaps 50 or 60 feet. But in the state I was in, that height loomed like a mountain. The tree was more inviting. I noticed its patch of shade. I tried to stand again. I managed to get to a squatting position, but as soon as I made to rise, my head spun and I couldn't keep my balance. And even if I hadn't fallen over, my legs had no strength left in them. But my will was strong. I was determined to move forward. I crawled, dragged myself, weakly leapfrogged to the tree. I know I will never know a joy so vast as I experienced when I entered that tree's dappled, shimmering shade and heard the dry, crisp sound of the wind rustling its leaves. The tree was not as large or as tall as the ones inland, and for being on the wrong side of the ridge, more exposed to the elements, it was a little scraggly and not so uniformly developed as its mates. But it was a tree, and a tree is a blessedly good thing to behold when you've been lost at sea for a long, long time. I sang that tree's glory, its solid, unhurried purity, its slow beauty. Oh, that I could be like it, rooted to the ground, but with my every hand raised up to God in praise. I wept. As my heart exalted Allah, my mind began to take in information about Allah's works. The tree did indeed grow right out of the algae, as I had seen from the lifeboat. There was not the least trace of soil. Either there was soil deeper down, or this species of tree was a remarkable instance of a commensal or a parasite. The trunk was about the width of a man's chest. The bark was grayish-green in color, thin and smooth, and soft enough that I could mark it with my fingernail. The caudate leaves were large and broad, and ended in a single point. The head of the tree had the lovely full roundness of a mango tree, but it was not a mango. I thought it smelled somewhat like a lote tree, but it wasn't a lote either. Nor a mangrove, nor any other tree I had ever seen. All I know was that it was beautiful and green and lush with leaves. I heard a growl. I turned. Richard Parker was observing me from the lifeboat. He was looking at the island, too. He seemed to want to come ashore, but was afraid. Finally, after much snarling and pacing, he leapt from the boat. I brought the orange whistle to my mouth, but he didn't have aggression on his mind. Simple balance was enough of a challenge. He was as wobbly on his feet as I was. When he advanced, he crawled close to the ground and with trembling limbs, like a newborn cub. Giving me a wide berth, he made for the ridge and disappeared into the interior of the island. I passed the day eating, resting, attempting to stand and, in a general way, bathing in bliss. I felt nauseous when I exerted myself too much, and I kept feeling that the ground was shifting beneath me and that I was going to fall over, even when I was sitting still. I started worrying about Richard Parker in the late afternoon. Now that the setting, the territory, had changed, I wasn't sure how he would take to me if he came upon me. Reluctantly, strictly for safety's sake, I crawled back to the lifeboat. However Richard Parker took possession of the island, the bow and the tarpaulin remained my territory. I searched for something to moor the lifeboat to. Evidently the algae covered the shore thickly, for it was all I could find. Finally, I resolved the problem by driving an oar, handle first, deep into the algae and tethering the boat to it. I crawled onto the tarpaulin. I was exhausted. My body was spent from taking in so much food, and there was the nervous tension arising from my sudden change of fortunes. As the day ended, I hazily remember hearing Richard Parker roaring in the distance, but sleep overcame me. I awoke in the night with a strange, uncomfortable feeling in my lower belly. I thought it was a cramp, that perhaps I'd poisoned myself with the algae. I heard a noise. I looked. Richard Parker was aboard. He had returned while I was sleeping. He was meowing and licking the pads of his feet. I found his return puzzling, but thought no further about it, The cramp was quickly getting worse. I was doubled over with pain, shaking with it, when a process, normal for most but long forgotten by me, set itself into motion. Defecation. It was very painful, but afterwards I fell into the deepest, most refreshing sleep I had had since the night before the Simsum sank. When I woke up in the morning, I felt much stronger. I crawled to the solitary tree in a vigorous way. My eyes feasted once more upon it, as did my stomach on the algae. I had such a plentiful breakfast that I dug a big hole. Richard Parker once again hesitated for hours before jumping off the boat. When he did, mid-morning, as soon as he landed on the shore, he jumped back and half fell in the water and seemed very tense. He hissed and clawed the air with a paw. It was curious. I had no idea what he was doing. His anxiety passed, and noticeably surer-footed than the previous day, he disappeared another time over the ridge. That day, leaning against the tree, I stood. I felt dizzy. The only way I could make the ground stop moving was to close my eyes and grip the tree. I pushed off and tried to walk. I fell instantly. The ground rushed up to me before I could move a foot. No harm done. The island, coated with such tightly woven, rubbery vegetation, was an ideal place to relearn how to walk. I could fall any which way. It was impossible to hurt myself. The next day, after another restful night on the boat, to which, once again, Richard Parker had returned, I was able to walk. Falling half a dozen times, I managed to reach the tree. I could feel my strength increasing by the hour. With the gaff, I reached up and pulled down a branch from the tree. I plucked off some leaves. They were soft and unwaxed, but they tasted bitter. Richard Parker was attached to his den on the lifeboat. That was my explanation for why he had returned another night. I saw him coming back that evening, as the sun was setting. I had re-tethered the lifeboat to the buried oar. I was at the bow, checking that the rope was properly secured to the stem. He appeared all of a sudden. At first I didn't recognize him. This magnificent animal bursting over the ridge at full gallop couldn't possibly be the same listless, bedraggled tiger who was my companion in misfortune. But it was. It was Richard Parker, and he was coming my way at high speed. He looked purposeful. His powerful neck rose above his lowered head. His coat and his muscles shook at every step. I could hear the drumming of his heavy body against the ground. I have read that there are two fears that cannot be trained out of us: the startled reaction upon hearing an unexpected noise, and vertigo. I would like to add a third, to wit, the rapid and direct approach of a known killer. I fumbled for the whistle. When he was 25 feet from the lifeboat, I blew into the whistle with all my might. A piercing cry split the air. It had the desired effect. Richard Parker braked, but he clearly wanted to move forward again. I blew a second time. He started turning and hopping on the spot in a most peculiar deer-like way, snarling fiercely. I blew a third time. Every hair on him was raised. His claws were full out. He was in a state of extreme agitation. I feared that the defensive wall of my whistle-blows was about to crumble and that he would attack me. Instead, Richard Parker did the most unexpected thing. He jumped into the sea. I was astounded. The very thing I thought he would never do, he did, and with might and resolve. He energetically paddled his way to the stern of the lifeboat. I thought of blowing again, but instead opened the locker lid and sat down, retreating to the inner sanctum of my territory. He surged onto the stern, quantities of water pouring off of him, making my end of the boat pitch up. He balanced on the gunwale and the stern bench for a moment, assessing me. My heart grew faint. I did not think I would be able to blow into the whistle again. I looked at him blankly. He flowed down to the floor of the lifeboat and disappeared under the tarpaulin. I could see parts of him from the edges of the locker lid. I threw myself upon the tarpaulin, out of his sight, but directly above him. I felt an overwhelming urge to sprout wings and fly off. I calmed down. I reminded myself forcefully that this had been my situation for the last long while, to be living with a live tiger hot beneath me. As my breathing slowed down, sleep came to me. Sometime during the night, I awoke and, my fear forgotten, looked over. He was dreaming. He was shaking and growling in his sleep. He was loud enough about it to have woken me up. In the morning, as usual, he went over the ridge. I decided that as soon as I was strong enough, I would go exploring the island. It seemed quite large, if the shoreline was any indication. Left and right it stretched on with only a slight curve, showing the island to have a fair girth. I spent the day walking, and falling, from the shore to the tree and back, in an attempt to restore my legs to health. At every fall, I had a full meal of algae. When Richard Parker returned as the day was ending, a little earlier than the previous day, I was expecting him. I sat tight and did not blow the whistle. He came to the water's edge and in one mighty leap reached the side of the lifeboat. He entered his territory without intruding into mine, only causing the boat to lurch to one side. His return to form was quite terrifying. The next morning, after giving Richard Parker plenty of advance, I set off to explore the island. I walked up to the ridge. I reached it easily, proudly moving one foot ahead of the other in a gait that was spirited, if still a little awkward. Had my legs been weaker, they would have given way beneath me when I saw what I saw beyond the ridge. To start with details, I saw that the whole island was covered with the algae, not just its edges. I saw a great green plateau with a green forest in its center. I saw all around this forest hundreds of evenly scattered, identically sized ponds with trees sparsely distributed in a uniform way between them, the whole arrangement giving the unmistakable impression of following a design. But it was the meerkats that impressed themselves most indelibly on my mind. I saw in one look what I would conservatively estimate to be hundreds of thousands of meerkats. The landscape was covered in meerkats, and when I appeared, it seemed that all of them turned to me, astonished, like chickens in a farmyard, and stood up. We didn't have any meerkats in our zoo, but I had read about them. They were in the books and in the literature. A meerkat is a small South African mammal related to the mongoose. In other words, a carnivorous burrower, a foot long and weighing 2 pounds when mature, slender and weasel-like in build, with a pointed snout, eyes sitting squarely at the front of its face, short legs, paws with 4 toes and long non-retractile claws and an 8-inch tail. Its fur is light brown to gray in color with black or brown bands on its back, while the tip of its tail, its ears, and the characteristic circles around its eyes are black. It is an agile and keen-sighted creature, diurnal and social in habits, and feeding in its native range, the Kalahari Desert of southern Africa, on, among other things, scorpions, to whose venom it is completely immune. When it is on the lookout, the meerkat has the peculiarity of standing perfectly upright on the tips of its back legs, balancing itself tripod-like with its tail. Often a group of meerkats will take the stance collectively, standing in a huddle and gazing in the same direction, looking like commuters waiting for a bus. The earnest expression on their faces and the way their front paws hang before them make them look either like children self-consciously posing for a photographer or patients in a doctor's office stripped naked and demurely trying to cover their genitals. That is what I beheld in one glance. Hundreds of thousands of meerkats, more, a million, turning to me and standing at attention as if saying, "Yes, sir?" Mind you, a standing meerkat reaches up 18 inches at most, so it was not the height of these creatures that was so breathtaking as their unlimited multitude. I stood rooted to the spot, speechless. If I set a million meerkats fleeing in terror, the chaos would be indescribable. But their interest in me was short-lived. After a few seconds, they went back to doing what they had been doing before I appeared, which was either nibbling at the algae or staring into the ponds. To see so many beings bending down at the same time reminded me of prayer time in a mosque. The creatures seemed to feel no fear. As I moved down from the ridge, none shied away or showed the least tension at my presence. If I had wanted to, I could have touched one, even picked one up. I did nothing of the sort. I simply walked into what was surely the largest colony of meerkats in the world, one of the strangest, most wonderful experiences of my life. There was a ceaseless noise in the air. It was their squeaking, chirping, twittering, and barking. Such were their numbers and the vagaries of their excitement that the noise came and went like a flock of birds, at times very loud, swirling around me, then rapidly dying off as the closest meerkats fell silent while others, further off, started up. Were they not afraid of me because I should be afraid of them? The question crossed my mind. But the answer, that they were harmless, was immediately apparent. To get close to a pond, around which they were densely packed, I had to nudge them away with my feet so as not to step on one. They took to my barging without any offense, making room for me like a good-natured crowd. I felt warm, furry bodies against my ankles as I looked into a pond. All the ponds had the same round shape and were about the same size, roughly 40 feet in diameter. I expected shallowness. I saw nothing but deep, clear water. The ponds seemed bottomless, in fact, and as far down as I could see, their sides consisted of green algae. Evidently, the layer atop the island was very substantial. I could see nothing that accounted for the meerkat's fixed curiosity, and I might have given up on solving the mystery had squeaking and barking not erupted at a pond nearby. Meerkats were jumping up and down in a state of great ferment. Suddenly, by the hundreds, they began diving into the pond. There was much pushing and shoving as the meerkats behind vied to reach the pond's edge. The frenzy was collective. Even tiny mere kittens were making for the water, barely being held back by mothers and guardians. I stared in disbelief. These were not standard Kalahari Desert meerkats. Standard Kalahari Desert meerkats do not behave like frogs. These meerkats were most definitely a subspecies that had specialized in a fascinating and surprising way. I made for the pond, bringing my feet down gingerly, in time to see meerkats swimming, actually swimming, and bringing to shore fish by the dozens, and not small fish either. Some were dorados that would have been unqualified feasts on the lifeboat. They dwarfed the meerkats. It was incomprehensible to me how meerkats could catch such fish. It was as the meerkats were hauling the fish out of the pond, displaying real feats of teamwork, that I noticed something curious. Every fish, without exception, was already dead. Freshly dead. The meerkats were bringing ashore dead fish they had not killed. I kneeled by the pond, pushing aside several excited wet meerkats. I touched the water.